The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Frank Urban for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from Smithsonian, the magazine of the Smithsonian Institution. Today's program is underwritten with the generous support of Carl and Pat Keppen. We thank them for their support. And today we read from the July-August combined edition. First article is called Fueling the Future by Clive Thompson. Back in the 19th century, coal was America's newfangled fuel source, and it faced the same resistance as wind and solar today. Stephen Priester's house in Washington, D.C. is a piece of American history, a gorgeous 110-year-old colonial with wooden columns and a front porch, perfect for relaxing in the summer. But Priester, who has owned it for almost four decades, is deeply concerned about the environment. So, in 2014, he added something very modern, solar panels. First, he mounted panels on the back of the house, and they worked nicely. Then he decided to add more on the front, facing the street, and applied to the city for a permit. Permission denied. Washington's Historic Preservation Review Board ruled that front-facing panels would ruin the house's historic appearance. I applaud your greenness, Chris Landis, an architect and board member, told Priester at a meeting in October 2019, but I just have this vision of row houses with solar panels on the front of them, and it just upsets me. Some of Priester's neighbors were equally dismayed and vowed to stop him. There were two women on my front porch snapping pictures of my house and declaring, "You'll never get solar panels on this house," Priester says. Renewable energy is at a curious crossroads. It's needed to avert further climate change, and solar and wind power are now remarkably cheap. But even clean energy proponents often dislike the aesthetics of the new technology. They're happy for solar arrays and windmills to exist somewhere, just not within their sight. Many homeowners' associations refuse to let residents install panels. This is the great new shift we're facing. For decades, gas and coal-fired plants were tucked far away from view, but now power generation is visible all over. There's really no other energy source that people have that personal relationship with, says Abigail Ross Hopper, president and CEO of the Solar Energy Industries Association. Yet this struggle has a long history. Ironically, coal itself faced a similar pushback in the early 19th century when it was the newfangled power source that promised to solve many of the country's problems. Until the early 1800s, Americans burned very little coal. The country was thickly forested, and wood was cheap. Most houses had one or more wood fireplaces. The country didn't have many factories that required serious energy, and coal was a niche fuel used, for example, by blacksmiths who needed high heat for their work. But as cities grew rapidly and demanded ever more fuel, choppers quickly deforested surrounding areas. Firewood became scarce and expensive. By 1744, Ben Franklin was bemoaning the plight of his fellow Philadelphians. Wood, our common fuel, which within these 100 years might be had at every man's door, must now be fetched near 100 miles to some towns, and make a very considerable article of the expensive families, he wrote. Johann David Schott, a German physician and botanist who traveled through America during and after the Revolutionary War, fretted that all this wood burning would not leave for American grandchildren a bit of wood over which to hang the tea kettle. Part of the problem was that a fireplace was a profligate way to heat a house, since so much heat vanished up the chimney. a lot of the open hearth wood fires were just insanely inefficient, says Christopher Jones, a historian at Arizona State University who studies early American power generation. America was sitting right atop the answer to this fuel crisis in the form of massive piles of coal, particularly Pennsylvania's loads of anthracite, a dense rock-like form of the stuff. Anthracite was ideal for burning in houses because it didn't produce as much smoke as soft bituminous coal. No longer simply the province of blacksmiths, coal became a hot commodity, and mining ramped up. Companies began increasingly ambitious anthracite digs, then began building canals and railroads to distribute the fuel to the east and south. But convincing Americans to use the new fuel proved tricky. In the years before massive factories, the main consumers of power were households. Houses were the beachhead market for coal, Jones says. House by house, coal merchants had to persuade Americans to shift over from wood. One obstacle was technological. Burning coal required metal ovens, which were still expensive and rare. But a more complex barrier was cultural. Many people hated the aesthetics of stoves because they were enclosed, and you couldn't see the flames within as you could in a traditional fireplace. In articles and speeches, prominent American citizens protested, denouncing stoves as essentially un-American. In an 1864 essay, Harriet Beecher Stowe fulminated, "Would our Revolutionary fathers have gone barefooted and bleeding over snows to defend airtight stoves and cooking ranges? I trow believe not." In his 1843 short story, Fire Worship, Nathan Hawthorne argued that gathering before a flickering hearth was crucial to bringing families and citizens together. Social intercourse cannot long continue what it has been, now that we have subtracted from it so important an element as firelight. Hawthorne fretted. While a man was true to the fireside, so long would he be true to country and law. The cultural arguments piled up. Food cooked in stoves was baked, not broiled, and that, too, offended American tastes. Meanwhile, Andrew Jackson Downing, an early landscape architect, argued in 1850 that stoves were secret poisoners, worse than slavery, tobacco, or patent medicines. People were blaming coal-fired stoves for impaired vision, impaired nerves, baldness, and tooth decay, says Barbara Fries, author of Coal, A Human History. It certainly smelled less pleasant than wood. Further, coal, particularly soft coal, produces soot, which choked some towns with dangerous particulates. Apart from the cultural backlash, coal was a pain to light. Anthracite stoves often required multiple attempts to start the flame and demanded constant fiddling with a poker. An 1827 guide for servants devoted 15 full pages to the black art. One period analysis found that new stoves added an hour of work to a housewife's chores. The mining and railroad industry set out on a marketing binge. They hosted demonstrations at hotels, inviting curious locals to marvel at how much heat a coal stove could generate. Certainly, wealthy elites behaved like Instagram influencers, evangelizing for anthracite and creating a romantic sense of coal as the fuel of the fashionable, says Sean Adams, a professor of history at the University of Florida and author of Home Fires, How Americans Kept Warm in the 19th Century. The wealthy were often investors in mines and railroads, too, so they had a vested interest in making coal take off. In an 1825 letter promoting coal, Matthew Carey, a Philadelphia publisher, boasted that it kept his room a toasty 60 degrees Fahrenheit during chilly months. "My feet used to be cold almost always at night in winter," he wrote. "Since I have used this coal, those grievances have removed entirely." Governments also helped. State officials conducted surveys to identify the yield of coal fields, then published the findings to inspire confidence in investors. To make fuel and stoves more affordable for low-income households, coal interests arranged to buy coal in bulk during the summer, when prices were low, to sell to the poor in the winter, and even lent metal stoves to poorer families. Gradually, the technology improved, too. By the mid-19th century, new stoves let you simply dump fuel into the top to keep the fire going, and stove makers lavished attention on the designs of their ranges, with some models becoming almost set pieces. They'd put busts of George Washington on top of the stove, and stuff like that, so that you could have it in your parlor, Adams says. By the 1860s, American households were finally and rapidly shifting to coal. It was often cheaper than wood. In 1831, for example, Adams estimates that a family would have spent $4.50 on coal in the cold months, while wood would have cost them $21. Still, supply was sometimes a problem. The wealthy had ample funds to buy coal in bulk, so they got better prices than the poor. Local coal sellers became derided figures among the lower classes, mocked in songs and poems for their alleged greed. Coal merchants were all over the place in the late 19th century, and everybody hated them, Adams says. That didn't stop coal's relentless march. By 1885, homes were burning more coal than wood, particularly in the big cities. The new fuel had won. These days, the need to transition to renewable energy seems alarmingly clear. Besides contributing to climate change, pollution from coal kills 500,000 people globally each year. As historians point out, studying our early objections to coal can prepare us for road bumps ahead. It shows that transitions to new fuels can be messy and fractious. A lot of coal companies went bankrupt in the 19th century. It was an incredibly disorganized industry, Adams says. These transitions take a long time, and they are sloppy, and they're intermittent. What's more, coal shows the need for further tech breakthroughs to make new fuels less of a hassle. With coal, Americans needed improved stoves and railways to transport the fuel. Today, we need better ways to store and transport renewable electricity. And cultural fights will continue as more and more solar panels appear, including the industrial arrays that have taken over fields from Death Valley, California to Lewiston, New York. Much like the old coal merchants, today's renewable industries have a sales job on their hands. Hopper thinks solar proponents need to promote the upsides more persuasively, not just the climate benefits, which most Americans want, but also the prospect of cheaper electricity and the local jobs that come with solar and wind. Aesthetic objections might soon fade too. Priester, for one, has found a solution. Solar skin, made by a Boston-based firm, it's a decorative film printed with a photographic pattern of a roof that camouflages the panels underneath. When he proposed this sleek design to the D.C. Preservation Board in December 2019, it finally approved his additional array. These days, he notes, the board is more amenable to the technology on historic houses. "I never found solar panels ugly in the first place," Priester laughs. And there's an insert here that says, read about the history of canaries in coal mines at smithsonianmag.com/fuel. There is a chart here where Americans get their energy. And it says, wither coal? Question mark. Coal-fired power peaked in 2007, then declined 61% by 2020. It surged in 2021, spurred by rising natural gas prices. Water power, as recently as 1950, hydropower generated 30% of the nation's electricity, and it remained the leading renewable source until 2019, when it was overtaken by wind. For now, water-driven production outstrips that of solar, supplying 6% of U.S. power. Nuclear capacity. As of 2021, 19% of the electricity generated in the United States is nuclear. Solar on the rise. Since 2008, solar capacity has increased nearly 300-fold and is sufficient to power some 18 million homes. Since 2014, the average cost of solar panels has dropped nearly 70%. And there are some small pictures here of a coal, sorry to say a coal field, a coal pile. And then natural gas is another way of generating electricity, nuclear, solar, wind. The caption for these pictures from left, coal in Wyoming, a natural gas flare in North Dakota, Pennsylvania's Limerick nuclear power plant, solar panels in Death Valley, California, and windmills in Hawaii. Net electricity generated in kilowatt hours, CO2 emissions in metric tons, and cost per energy generated by megawatts. The way they have their chart, it shows that each of those are about the same as far as amount used. And that was Fueling the Future by Clive Thompson. Up next, The Real Deal. The founding document of Liberia went missing for nearly 200 years. Then a Maryland historian began his search, by Amy Crawford. In December 1821, the U.S. Navy schooner Alligator, under the command of Lieutenant Robert F. Stockton, sailed down Africa's windward coast to anchor off a rock headland known as Cape Misurato. The Alligator's usual assignment was to patrol the area for American ships engaging in the transatlantic slave trade, which the United States had outlawed 13 years earlier. But on this voyage, Stockton was transporting a New Jersey physician named Eli Ayers, an agent for the American Colonization Society, which was seeking a permanent home in Africa for free black Americans. The two men spent 4 days ashore negotiating a contract with local leaders to purchase a narrow tract of land that scholars estimated covered about 140 acres. Payment would come in the form of trade goods, including guns, gunpowder, tobacco, rum, tableware, utensils, shoes, hats, umbrellas, and mirrors, together worth roughly $7,000 in today's money. Both parties also pledged to, quote, live in peace and friendship forever. Ayers recorded the deal in careful script on the front and back of a single sheet of paper. He signed it along with Stockton and six local leaders who referred to themselves as Peter, George, Zoda, Long Peter, Governor, and Jimmy. They were called kings in the contract, although they were not monarchs in the European sense. The written agreement, not unusual for the era, if astonishingly casual to the modern legalistic mind, is the founding document of the nation that would become Liberia. American newspapers published accounts of the purchase and transcripts of the contract after Ayers returned to the United States. But in 1835, a committee of the American Colonization Society reported that the document itself was missing, the last time the contract was known to be cited in print. Over the ensuing decades, that loss contributed to the myth that the contract had never existed at all, that the Americans had simply seized the land by force or fraud. Not often is a historian presented with such a high-stakes challenge. Find a nearly 200-year-old sheet of paper, which may not even be real, that launched a new nation. But it was a challenge that C. Patrick Burrows, a former Penn State University professor who has spent much of his career researching Liberia's early history, was eager to take on. So exactly two centuries after the document was supposedly drafted, Burroughs set out to solve the existential mystery and clarify our understanding of a critical chapter of U.S. and African history. The American Colonization Society was founded in 1816 by a group of white clergymen and political leaders who saw repatriation to Africa as a possible future for free black Americans. Among its supporters were slaveholders who feared that the increasing number of free black people living in the South might foment uprisings, and white abolitionists who believed an African homeland offered the best chance for black self-determination. For their part, black anti-slavery activists tended to be more skeptical of the scheme. Still, many of those backing the ACS simply hoped to alleviate political tensions, then growing around the question of slavery, Burroughs says. They thought, if we can get a colony for free blacks, we take the pressure off. Of course, the pressure would keep building until it exploded in the Civil War. But meanwhile, the ACS pursued its vision. In March 1820, its first ship carrying 86 settlers arrived in Sierra Leone, landing at swampy Sherbo Island. But the ACS was unable to persuade local residents to sign over land. Besides, the island was plagued by mosquitoes that carried malaria and other diseases. ACS officials turned to Cape Mesurado, about 150 miles to the southeast, on the advice of Lieutenant Matthew C. Perry of the U.S. Navy, who was posted in the area. The ACS resettled the Sherbo repatriates to Mesurado and named the area Liberia to signify that it was a home for free people. Because Ayres kept a detailed journal of the 1821 journey to Cape Mesurado, and newspapers printed the text of the agreement, we know much of what happened that December, but the absence of the original document left an enormous hole in the historical record. Burroughs kept hunting down a phantom document that no one had seen in nearly two centuries would not be easy. Having exhausted the official records of the ACS, he broadened his search to include the archives of lawyers known to have worked for the society. Perhaps one had stowed the document away and forgotten about it. Early in his search, Burroughs looked into Francis Scott Key, better known as the lyricist behind the Star-Spangled Banner. But the hunt through Key's papers archived in Baltimore proved fruitless. Next was Elias Caldwell, who had clerked for the Supreme Court during the tenure of Justice Bushrod Johnson, President George Washington's nephew and an ACS co-founder. Charles Gunther, an Illinois collector, had donated some of Caldwell's paper to the Chicago History Museum, and among the drafts of Supreme Court decisions and an insurance policy for Mount Vernon were records of Caldwell's work for the ACS. It was August 2021, and pandemic precautions kept Burroughs from visiting the museum. He asked archivists to send him scans of the entire Bushrod Washington archive, hundreds of documents, each page of which he reviewed. "I really was about to give up," Burroughs recalls in a phone interview from his home in Columbia, Maryland. Then he found himself gazing at a scan of severely yellowed letter with unmistakably elegant 19th century handwriting, the Liberia Purchase Contract. That was the highest point of my professional career, he recalls. The discovery, which Burroughs presented earlier this year in a talk to the Library of Congress, has electrified historians who study slavery, abolition, and the deep ties between the United States and Liberia. One might think about it as the difference between having a transcription of the Declaration of Independence and the actual declaration, says Eric Byrne, a historian at the University of North Dakota and author of a 2005 book about the ACS called Slavery and the Peculiar Situation. This is a very important document in Liberian history. Burroughs compared a high-resolution copy of the contract with known samples of Eyre's handwriting. They matched. That alone was significant, since the accepted wisdom was that Stockton penned the document. Most important, the discovery will help put to rest the claim long advanced by historians and others that no legitimate contract ever existed, an idea that has helped fuel political tensions and conflict in Liberia between indigenous groups and the descendants of formerly enslaved settlers. That particular myth arose in the mid-20th century when some American historians re-examining U.S.-African relations from a perspective critical of American colonialism suggested that Stockton and Ayres took advantage of the African leaders by forcing the deal at gunpoint, an infamous scene of pistol diplomacy, as one author put it. Others asserted that the Africans did not understand Western notions of property and could not meaningfully consent to the sale. On the other side of the Atlantic, black Americans were faced with a fraught choice. Most, like abolitionist leader Frederick Douglass, found the prospect of immigration not only unenticing, but insulting. As Douglass would later put it in a 1852 newspaper editorial, there's no sentiment more universally entertained nor more firmly held by the free colored people of the United States than that this is their own, their native land. Still, plenty of African Americans decided to seek a different destiny in Liberia. Once the few dozen settlers left Sherbo Island for Cape Mesurado in April 1822, the colony quickly expanded, and the ACS renegotiated further land transfers with local leaders. By 1838, tens of thousands of free black American repatriates were living in the city that would become Liberia's capital, Monrovia, named after President James Monroe, and had been in office at the time of the Cape Mesurado Purchase. We hope you've enjoyed today's edition of Smithsonian. I'm Frank Urban for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's programming is underwritten with the generous support of Carl and Pat Keppen. We thank them for their support. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Our podcast is available on our website, ncreadingservice.org. So long until next time. If you have any comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138.